we actually planned to do this a while back.
We did back a ways.
Wasn't it?
We got preempted over some stuff or something.
Wasn't it in conjunction with Teen Weekend?
Probably. That sounds about right. That was in April. That was in April.
Yeah. We were wanting to come off Teen Weekend and talk about our kids and got bumped by some other things. But it also falls at a good time right now because it's graduation season.
Yep.
Right?
Got some folks doing some big life changes, big transitions for some families.
Eight.
Yeah. And a lot of them were first graduates in their family. Mom and dad are adjusting this weekend too.
Oh, that adjustment didn't come till August.
Yeah, fair.
Right? Fair. Right? You panicking back there, Petties? With August coming up pretty soon? Yeah. Yeah. Eight graduates, what that represents is a sizable number of kids that we have here at Kleinwood. I counted the last time I taught, which was a quarterback, we had 30 kids assigned to the high school class. They don't all show up at one time because if they did, I don't know where we'd put them all.
Right.
But we do have 30 kids assigned that class, 20 in the junior high class. And don't ask me about everything under that because that's that end of the hall and I don't do anything on that end of the hall.
50-ish kids on this end of the hall.
Yeah, 50-ish kids. And so Jeff and I wanted to just take some time tonight to talk as a family about our young people. We know that they matter to you, the parents and the grandparents and the extended family. We want to say again how much they matter to us. And it's a blessing to get to work with these kids.
Oh, absolutely.
To get to spend the
time. One of the great things about this congregation.
Yeah, in the class. But we want you to know as well that taking care of these young people is just one of the highest priorities of the Kleinwood Church. We consider it to be one of the most important things that we are trying to do together. And while I don't want to speak for the elders, I could tell you that I know that they share that concern because they talk to us about that.
Right. We regularly in our meetings talk about this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And I know that they are very concerned about seeing the young people here do well. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about that tonight. One of the reasons that is such a high priority to us, and I know you've heard us say this before, and we're not saying this as something new to present to the group to consider, but we are saying it because we want to keep rehearsing it and keeping it in front of us all the time. And that is, these young people, these 50 high school students, high school and junior high students, for example, are the most at-risk group among us.
Well, yeah. I mean, they, statistically, there's a large spiritual casualty rate out of that group.
Don't miss the point here because Jeff and I certainly believe that every soul is important and we're not trying to attach greater value to anyone over anybody else. That's not the point of this.
Every lost sheep is important.
Yeah, every one of the sheep is important. But the fact that we are seeing today among God's people such a substantial number of young people growing up and becoming unbelievers, walking away from faith. Right. Those are numbers that concern us. And it's important to us that we not ignore those realities, but that we embrace them and recognize them and think more about what we're going to do to help our kids. It isn't just a statistic, and I was thinking about this over the last couple of days as I was pondering tonight. Sometimes we look at statistics, it's just numbers.
Yeah.
But guys, we know the kids, right? So I grew up at Kleinwood. I was here. I wonder if there's anyone here that would remember. I know many of you remember the old building. Do you ever remember the T building in the back? Yeah, so I went to Bible class in the T building in the back. In fact, I think Mark Richardson was one of my Bible class teachers. That's just so y'all know that he's a good bit older than I am. But
and still teaching you today.
Yes.
A little remedial work now.
Yeah, not, true. But I can name you some kids that I was close to that were in that Bible class with me that have left Jesus. My two best buddies when I was growing up here are no longer with the Lord. And now I've been doing this long enough that, well, you know, I used to come do teen weekends here. I used to do that all the time. This right. this was before your time. And
I'll let you have it.
And I had, y'all know I had Michael Bussman in my teen weekends. Michael back there somewhere? I was looking for him. I had Michael Bussman, which was weird because I got to know a whole nother group of Kleinwood kids when I would come and do those weekends, sometimes 3 or 4 or 5 years in a row. And I could tell you about some of those kids that aren't walking with Jesus anymore. And now, and this is what makes me feel really old, is now I've got Bussman's kids in Bible class, and that really makes me start feeling old, right? When the children of the people you taught,
right.
It's coming for you. Don't be laughing at me. But and so you start thinking about them. And in 20 years, 30 years, who won't be walking with Jesus anymore?
Well, and you know, David, even to make that personal, just for a lot of us who've grown up in congregation somewhere else, just think about how many people you grew up with who aren't faithful today. I mean, just make it personal. I mean, this is something that I think all of us ought to be, you know, kind of think about as we go from generation to generation and hand off the torch of faith in a congregation, so to speak. That this really needs to be, you know, even if you don't have kids anymore at home, you know, grandkids here, this ought to be your passion in this congregation that we're investing in the future for all of us. So Bible class teachers, I mean, you know, just those who encourage young parents, just across the board, all sorts of ways for us to share our passion, to do our best for kids who grew up in this congregation, give them the best possible chance to walk with the Lord for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think recognizing that these aren't just numbers on a page, but they're people, adds a whole new level of importance to all of this. And then factor in that they're living in a difficult world, right?
Right.
Now, in fairness, let's at least throw this all out. Maybe some of you have seen that some of the more recent data is saying that there is a resurgent interest in young people in spiritual things,
right?
And oddly enough, especially among young men, over the last, you know, what, 4 or 5 years, there's been an interest, a renewed interest in spiritual things, and I think that's kind of creating a buzz in the religious world today. And I really want that to be true,
right? But
I'm not sure statistically we're there yet.
No, and I think, you know, remember, young people are prone to fads in the moment anyways. I mean, people get, especially in the age of social media, things get cool and viral for a while, and religiosity can become cool and viral for a while. And if you doubt that, you know, those of us who are adults and think, you know, maybe somehow the massive tide of spirituality in this country is turning because of at least an apparent, at this moment, youthful enthusiasm about religion, go back and just Google statistics about anything from 10 years ago that were supposed to forecast the wave of the future, and think how well those statistics and trends from 10 years ago held up. Let's not start high-fiving about some sort of, you know, if you keep up with these kind of things and see these kind of headlines in the news, which David and I do, that, you know, stats and trends of the moment really do herald the wave of the future. It does not change the fact that we have a lot of work to do and a lot of intention to form around what we want to do.
Yeah. So there was a moment during teen weekend, and it may or may not have something to do with the fact that we wanted to come back and talk about kids, but the last segment of teen weekend this year was a Q&A with the kids. And
an ask us anything kind of thing.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
Any Bible question.
Anything was fair game.
Yeah, you know, whatever they wanted to. And so we got a question about young people dealing with friends who were homosexual and getting pressure to comment on and weigh in on how they felt about the lifestyle choice. And one of the young people was a fifth grader and looked like a fifth grader. And was saying to us that they were getting pressure at school from gay friends to weigh in on that. A fifth grader. Does that bug y'all? I mean, I know our kids got to deal with this. I'd like to think about, you know, people who are off at college having to deal about this. And I know it's younger than that. But this little fifth grader was talking about that struggle. And I got to tell you, that really rattled me. And I came away from that exchange just sort of thinking, yeah, it's a difficult world.
Well, and that's the thing, I think, for those of us who came of age in a different time, you know, before the internet, social media, the whole thing. You know, the realm of childhood innocence has shrunk greatly for our young people. They are robbed of their innocence about all manner of evil much earlier now because of where the culture's at.
I think that's right. And so I think it's good what it's going to require of us, of all of us. And I'm talking about parents. I'm talking about Bible class teacher. I'm talking about church family. I'm talking about, you know, grandparents and extended family. We're going to have some uncomfortable conversation, folks, to get our kids prepared to deal with these kinds of things. We can't, you know, just kind of bury our head in the sand and opt for homeschool or co-op and hope they don't get exposed to this.
Correct.
Stuff, right?
Because at the end of the day, the kids at homeschool and co-op still have smartphones or friends with smartphones. You know, unless you're going to, you know, lock your kid away, they're going to have extracurriculars. They're going to encounter the world in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
There's no hiding from this ultimately.
Yeah. And the reason I thought that was important to bring up is I remember years ago talking to a mom who had a teenage son, and she had, her and her husband had never had a conversation with him about sexual purity. And he's a teenager. And somehow that discussion came up with Heidi and I, and here was her pushback on it. She said, I'm not ready to do that because I just want to protect his innocence. I y'all are making funny faces. I wish I could photograph that and throw it up on the slide. Because what I'm reading in your faces is, you got to be kidding me, right? She's got a teenage son and she's worried about protecting his innocence. And I do think that is part of our struggle with this. And the fact that those conversations are uncomfortable. Talking to a fifth grader about a trans student. How awkward is that conversation? And when you were little, you and I could never imagine that being a necessary conversation. And yet that's exactly where we are. And so what I think we imagine is, I'm not going there because I'm protecting their innocence. I will get to that later. Here's the reality of it. Here's what we're really doing when we do that. We're leaving them vulnerable and unprepared when the conversation comes up way before we anticipate.
And the thing that's hard, you know, for those of us who are parenting today to think about a little bit is, you know, it used to be because the culture had more backstops in it, you know, and the culture had less ways to get into our kids. Again, internet, smartphone. And again, your kid doesn't have a smartphone. That's wonderful. Good. You know, that's a fine choice. But that doesn't mean their friends don't and they can't show them things, or their friends are telling them about what they've seen or learned on the internet or the phone. And so here's the reality. To your point, David, we're not protecting their innocence. What we're doing is we're allowing the world to set the narrative that we didn't have to play catch up to. And the trick of, you know, of all of this is, and again, wisdom's called for. You got to know your kids, their circumstances. But the reality is we want to be setting God's narrative about this stuff before we are playing catch up. Because, you know, we always talk about first impressions in the world matter. You know, first impressions about spiritual things matter. And when you're having to play catch-up, especially about really, really potent things like sexuality, when your kid's sense of what normal is has already been set by something that is utterly, utterly of the devil, and now you're playing catch-up and trying to have to undo what's been taken, rather than they see the danger or the foolishness initially because you've already said, hey, listen, you're going to hear in the world X, Y, Z. And by the way, you don't even have to tell your kids everything. If you just simply plant the seed that you're going to hear things about this in the world, and when you do, come talk to me because God has already spoken to anything you're going to hear in the world about this. You don't have to completely blow up their innocence, right? But you do have to sit there and say, look, you're not going to hear anything that's new to me or new to God. God's already spoken to this. If you're not going to have all of these conversations with your kids, you don't think it's appropriate, you can still say, listen, God has spoken about some things you're going to learn in the world. I want you to come hear God's version when you hear the world's version. God has already spoken to this.
I think that when I was a kid growing up,
yeah,
one of the things parents were trying to do was to teach their kids how to get along in the world without becoming like the world, right?
Yeah, right. In the world, but not of it.
Yeah. I think we're past that. And I think the stage we're in now is we need to prepare our children to do battle.
Well, I was going to say, that's the thing. There used to be that we at least for a while, maybe it was possible. Maybe we were just deceiving ourselves more than we realized even then.
I wonder if it's the second.
Agreed. But the bottom line is we used to believe at least that there was a way to be a Christian and not have conflict with the world. And folks, what's funny is, you know, again, I keep my finger in the larger religious world because of what I do, want to know where the winds are blowing and whatnot. And it's fascinating watching more conservative religious groups already recognize there is no way to avoid conflict with the world now. We are going to have to accept the fact that we're going to be haters of mankind and bigots again. And the world is going to scorn us. And especially the most important thing we can teach our kids, aside from the specifics we may be thinking about right now, moms and dads, the most important thing you have to teach your kids right now is you're going to have to understand in your generation, there's going to be an absolute struggle between you and the world, and you're going to have to accept the fact that the world is not going to like you. If you're worried about pleasing men, you cannot please God, and there are simply going to be consequences in your life for serving God over the world. And if we're not preparing our kids for that, then I'm not sure that we're, you know, forget the other issues on the table. Our kids have to be prepared for the fact that you're going to have to accept less than what my generation got in the world, because the conflict in your generation will be far more ferocious.
Yeah, I think that I think that we haven't appreciated that the crowd out there is hostile to Christianity and those who embrace it and those who follow it, which is why we need to prepare them for battle.
That's right.
Because the other side is hostile and bent and determined. And then I think about why is it that we forget to factor the devil into this? Have you all noticed how the devil doesn't get talked about nearly enough anymore? And the fact that he prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour, like Peter said. I don't think we talk enough about the fact that there is an adversary who is promoting this assault on disciples, and impress that on our children.
Yeah,
that it's genuine, real spiritual warfare.
Yeah.
That they're facing as they go out there.
Well, and to that point, you know, you went there, David. You know, one of my favorite verses. You mentioned the 1 Peter 5. For me, one of the most frightening verses in all the Bible is in Revelation 12 and verse 12. When John says this, you know, and again, it's the conflict between the dragon, who John explicitly identifies as Satan, as the devil, who's been defeated. You know, again, stripping away the imagery for a second of the confusion. But bottom line is, Satan has been already defeated by the cross of Christ and the resurrection, and the power and the work of God. And so, you know, Satan has been cast down, as it were, in the language and idiom of Revelation. But verse 12 is the frightening one. Because listen to what God and the glorified Christ were telling Christians, first century and 21st century. Rejoice, O heavens, you who dwell in them. Why? Because Satan's been defeated and you're safe now. You know, the saints under the all of that. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows his time is short. And so the bottom line is, and again, it goes on, the devil is here now, verse 17. The dragon became furious with the woman, went off to make war on the rest of her offspring. You hear what he's saying? He's angry, and he knows his time is short. Why? He knows he's lost now. The cross was his crushing of his head. He's angry, he knows he's lost, and he's here to make trouble for the people of God on earth. You may not be interested in Satan, but Satan's interested. You may not talk about him, but he is very much alert and active. And and by the way, one of my favorite sayings about Satan anyways, you don't have to worry about the world, he's already got them. All he has to do is focus on the people of God. We're the ones he doesn't have yet. And so we have his full attention. But Christ in heaven is explicit to his apostle John on earth. He's angry, he knows his time is short, and he fully intends in the time he has left to make war with God's people.
Somebody asked a question. We said there are some very recent numbers that show a renewed interest in spiritual things.
Yeah.
But the question was, isn't atheism also on the rise?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this is the thing about statistics, and, you know, and again, got to remember, the media loves to, because, you know, the media needs some new thing to stay in business, okay? So I'm going to remember just a couple years ago when we talked about the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, you know, the nuns, you know, the growth of atheism in Gen Z and Gen Alpha right behind it. And so here's the thing, ironically, and this is the fun of statistics, why statistics are so staggeringly misleading, especially in the context of headlines. Both are true. In other words, the younger generation is increasingly atheistic, even as relative to the atheist generation, there is right now apparently some sort of bump, how long remains to be seen, but some sort of bump in renewed religiosity. In other words, that's just saying there are fewer atheists at the moment, but the overall trend of atheism is upward. So whoever asked that, you know, nice, that's the whole point. Don't get caught in the clickbait headlines, because both are true. There is a bit of an uptick, but again, that's like saying, you know, from 5 to 10% are more religious now, while atheism went from 20 to 30%. Who's still winning? The atheists. And so, yeah, overall, the trends are not good, because there are other things we could talk about as well. Marriage rates among the young, porn rates. I mean, there are a whole other host that go into this. And again, the young people in particular are known for chasing fads of the moment. It's cool to follow YouTube influencers, social media influencers who are doing the apologetic stuff online right now. Talk to me in 5 years. Let's see where the thing, what's the truth by then?
Another person asked if we are uncomfortable and unprepared for these conversations, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Then how are we going to be able to get our children comfortable and prepared
Correct.
To have the conversations out in the yeah. world?
And, you know, in some ways, Dave, this goes back to evangelism, which I know is a great love of yours in particular and in your work over the years. You know, the reality is, folks, one of the best schools of evangelism is converting your own kids. I mean, we forget in one sense, our kids aren't Christians. You know, and that's what some things, you know, churches aren't growing because we're only converting our own kids. I still think those are souls added to the flock of God. Those aren't not nothing. You know, so you know, we need to be doing more with the world and with our kids. I think these days, you know, it's like the airline principle, right? Fix your own oxygen mask first. How about we worry about our own kids? You know, let's keep our own kids as much as we're worried about outside, because our kids are not part of the people of God. And so honestly, if you're struggling with how for yourself to even share your faith, you know what the best way to grow in your own faith is? Learn how to pass it on to your own kid, not just through the rote teaching of the Bible, but through the persuasive answering of their questions. You want to be able to answer people's questions of the world? Answer your own questions first. It's a great school. Learn how to answer your own kids' questions first. It's a great school for growing your own faith, showing your own kids a model of how to grow in faith, as well as to prepare yourself for, because your kids aren't going to have any questions that the world doesn't have either.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
I do think, though, that there is a point to be made to us about getting comfortable with some uncomfortable topics,
oh, yeah.
right?
Yeah. Nobody likes having certain conversations with anybody, let alone our own kids.
let's take what I think has been a notorious struggle for parents, and that is talking to kids about sex, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's almost a cultural understanding that parents are extraordinarily uncomfortable going there with their kids. And yet, folks, in our world, they are literally being blasted with messages about that all the time, and almost all the data that they're getting is wrong, right?
Because the world talks about this all the time. For a lot of us as adults, we just become radio, you know, white noise to us, you know, static. We're just so used to seeing the billboards, seeing the advertisements. You know, for kids who are just coming of age, you know, I will never forget the time years ago, one of my kids from the backseat when they're about 3 years old, they were driving past on I-45 in Houston. There was a beer billboard with a woman in a bikini, because everybody knows sex and beer go together. And my kid, one of my young kids at that time from the backseat says, "Dad, why is that woman naked?" Isn't that interesting? You know, background noise to me, I'm just trying not to hit the guy in front of me on I-45. You know how it is. But my kids sitting there very much, because it's new to them, and they're becoming sensitive to know, "Dad, why is that woman naked?" Background noise to us, not to our kids.
So, you know, the question is, if we're not going to have the conversation, who's going to have it with them? And I really challenge you to think about that. And so, I don't think it's necessary for parents to be comfortable with the topic. I just think it's necessary for you to be able to pretend that you're comfortable with the topic, okay? And I think that's good enough.
Fake it till you make it.
I think that's right. We did a parenting class a couple years ago, and I shared with you what was our family strategy about that topic, and that is we very much were what you said earlier, where we were in that same place. We want the right information before the wrong information, right?
Yeah.
And so when our kids were 9 years old, this was a long time ago, when our kids were 9 years old, on their 9th birthday, they got all the information, right? We explained everything about where babies come from and laid all the right terminology for all the body parts, everything. Mom and dad having a conversation, privacy of our home. But the thing we said to our kids was, this is only the first conversation. And we pretended to be real comfortable with this. And we said, you can come talk to us about this at any time. And I will, if there's any consolation in this, it does get easier over time. I do remember when my son was in sixth grade, started junior high for the first time, and when he got home from school, he came up to me and said, remember when you said I could ask you anything? That's bad, okay? Put on your no freak out face. He said, I heard three words today at school, and I don't know what they are. And yeah, that was another one of those memorable parenting moments, right? But who do we want him to go talk to about that? Right? And he didn't have you access to the internet at that time. I certainly didn't want him to Google it or go to YouTube. And so coming back to the question, you know, we're uncomfortable with the conversations. I don't have a better answer to that than to say we need to get comfortable with the conversations. And let our kids know that we can talk about these things, right?
I know, just to make that point, this is one of the things that both you and I emphasize when we go in the high school class and take our turns in the high school class is we want this to be a place where you can ask anything. Nothing that will be shocking. Nothing will, cause us to freak out. We want this to be a place where questions can be asked. And so we need to be cultivating that in our homes as well.
Let me take us in a new direction because I want to tap into something that I think is really important. Have you ever considered how long parents have struggled to keep their kids walking with the Lord? You ever thought about that? How far back that struggle goes? I mean, obviously, it's been true for every generation represented in this audience, right? But it's further than that. And someone says, well, yeah, I mean, like all the way back to Bible times. How far back in the Bible do we go and see this struggle with parents who are trying to get kids to do the right thing and follow the Lord? Genesis chapter 4, with Adam and Eve and their boys, one of whom was murderously rebellious. Think about that. This has been something that parents have struggled with literally from the beginning and on down through time. I always think about Samuel, because Samuel's a good guy in the Bible, right? And he does what dads do. As he gets older, he gets his sons, and he wants his sons to kind of follow in his footsteps. In 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3, if you want to look at that text, 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3, his sons don't do what their father did. They're wicked and corrupt, and they take bribes, and you could just imagine how they broke their father's heart in the process of all of that.
And there's always that warning to me that's frightening to me, because Eli was a good man.
Yep.
And he failed, but he failed to pass it on to his sons.
Didn't take care of his kids.
Well, and that's just it, is while he wanted to have the role, he didn't prepare them for the role. And so there's always that line in chapter 3 of 1 Samuel that haunts me. And I think for every one of us who are parents, when God says to Eli, I'm going to punish his house, verse 13 of 1 Samuel 3, I will punish his house forever for the iniquity he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. Oh, there's such a dangerous thing about not, in God's eyes, doing what we need to be doing with our kids. And so Eli, as good as he was, because I think Eli was not singled out for his own participation in the sins of Israel. He was he was singled out by God for his failures to be the father he was supposed to be to his sons. And but he wanted to have the job when they were utterly unprepared for it. And God calls him out for it.
Well, think about too how we see this in the life of David, King David. Because David's a man after God's own heart, right?
Yeah.
He's a good guy. And yet we know on the back end of his life, he was deeply grieved over the behavior of his children.
Yeah.
And to a degree, he's responsible for some of that.
Oh, absolutely.
And part of it is he didn't deal with some of the stuff with his kids, right?
Well, and that's exactly right. I mean, that was the whole, he didn't deal with Amnon when Amnon, raped Tamar. And so Absalom took justice into his own hands. And then he didn't deal with Absalom. Absalom's bitterness and resentment grew until he leads a revolution and rebellion. I mean, and so part of it is literally, it's not just that David sinned with Bathsheba and set a bad example for his kids, but then he did not deal with his kids.
Yeah, struggle's been going on from the beginning, though. Yeah. And all down throughout time, parents have struggled to get their kids to continue to walk with the Lord. So one of the things that I would invite you to consider with me tonight is if we are seeing lots of young people abandon their faith, then maybe it's time for us to reassess the status quo of what we're doing as parents. It's real easy to just sort of fall into the trap of doing what we see everyone around us doing, right? Even to get pulled into the patterns that are being followed by people in the world. So I get my kids into the things that people in the world are getting their kids into, and we spend the kind of time with those things that people in the world spend with those things, and we just kind of follow along with what other parents are doing. Maybe we need to consider shaking that up. And maybe it's time to reconsider the status quo, because the status quo is leading to a lot of kids being lost.
Right. And let's kind of, you know, speak to this from other directions as well. One of the things that we as the people of God often struggle with is, just like Israel looked at the nations around them, too often we look at other religious groups and what they're doing for their youth or their youth groups and think, you know, that's the way to reach our young people, because look at how, you know, full their youth groups are and whatnot. And, you know, and again, what's funny is, going back to, you know, when we talk about statistics and everything else, what some of these religious groups are realizing is, you know, pizza and video games may have packed them in numerically, but when these kids get older and going to youth group, they don't come back for church. You know, even in the denominational sense, because they were converted to fun, and now they just find fun. Now when they're 21, they can do a different kind of fun called drinking. You know, right? I mean, you see how this works. Because they were taught, you know, that Jesus is fun as opposed to Jesus is about sacrificing myself, serving the Lord, no matter, et cetera, et cetera. And so the thing is, you know, sometimes we have to be very careful. We look around the world at us and think, we need to be doing what these people are doing or we're going to lose our kids. And the reality is, guess what? The church, you know, some of these religious groups are learning more and more. They've lost their kids anyways because they did not teach them the truth about Jesus. You know, not just, you know, the happy stuff, but the hard stuff. You know, that sin. You know, not just Jesus is your buddy, your boyfriend, your helper. Sin. Jesus will judge. You know, all that stuff we don't want to hear. And so let's not be looking around the world, to your point about the status quo. Too often, part of where we get the status quo is we want to be like all the nations because it seems to work numerically, and we forget that they're losing their kids. You know, kids who grew up in youth group and still think God is okay with homosexuality. How does that happen? I'll tell you how. Because pizza doesn't change anybody's heart. That's how.
Wow, I wish you hadn't brought that up, because I want to say so much about that.
Well, feel right? Free. Nobody's stopping you.
I'm just watching the clock as we're doing
this. I never do that. Don't worry about it.
They know.
That's why I can say it.
I share that concern of getting caught up in the youth group movement. And that experiment, what's probably been going on about 60 years,
yeah,
which fundamentally,
generations now,
which fundamentally the idea is that young people cannot be genuinely spiritual. You got to lure them to church with carnal things and try to slip in spiritual things. That's basically,
yeah,
how the philosophy
a bait and switch
worked. And I got to tell you, folks, in our religious, with our religious neighbors, that has been a colossal failure. I don't know why folks didn't see that coming, because putting someone who's just barely not a teenager in charge of young people,
right,
is not a biblical approach to this. The whole idea biblically is that older people teach younger people.
Right.
Again, another fundamental piece of that. But when I first started writing material for Bible classes, I bought a lot of stuff from an outfit called Youth Specialties, clip art and stuff like that. Okay. And there was a guy, Mike Iaconelli, who was the president of that organization. He was sort of the guru of youth group back around 2000. And I remember 2003, he wrote an article. And in the article, he was really brutally honest about that. And he basically just said, youth group has been a failure.
Yeah.
He said, kids aren't coming to these concerts because they're interested in Jesus. They're coming to these concerts because they're kids.
Right.
And they're not getting any kind of spiritual foundation. And it was a stunning article for a guy who had been the guru of youth group at that time. And the sad thing about that is he was killed in an automobile accident in 2004. And so that was kind of his last word, in essence, leaving the followers of that philosophy with, well, what do you do?
Oops.
And I can tell you what's happening in a lot of the religious groups that are out there, folks. They're coming back around and they're saying, we don't need to give our kids more pizza and we don't need to build a bigger gym. We need to teach them the Bible. Amen. What a novel concept. And we worry about the amount of kids that we're losing, but I'm telling you, it's worse than the denominations that are out there. The answer is not in what our religious neighbors are doing. The answer is back in God's book. And so I want us to touch on that. That's kind of why I was watching the clock, to be sure we didn't fail to talk about where this battle is won or lost. And I think the first thing we need to say about that is that the battle is won or lost in the heart of every person.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I'm saying that because I want to freak out the parents in the crowd. Because I think we like to believe
there's a formula to the raising your kids to stay faithful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If I will just check all the boxes and set the dials all right, then it will turn out perfectly with my kids. I'll have guaranteed success with them, right?
Right.
Bring them up in the way that they should go. Even when they're old, they won't depart from it.
Right. Right?
And the truth is, there aren't any guarantees. You can do all of the right things as a parent, and your child becomes an adult and says, that's not what I want to do. Because that's what they decided in their heart.
Right.
Right?
And that's terrifying as a parent.
It is.
But you have to make peace with it. You know, if in the perfection of Eden, Adam and Eve could still choose sin, then there simply is no perfection that you or I can offer that will guarantee our children will not love the world more than they love God when it comes time for them to make these choices on their own in life.
Now, I'm not saying that parents are irrelevant.
Correct.
Okay? Did anybody hear that?
Correct.
This is not what I'm saying. I think the cool thing about being parents is that we get to be part of the process.
We can certainly put our thumb on the scale
yes.
of what they're going to become.
Yes. If you brought your kids to worship tonight, see, you're putting your thumb on the scale, just like Jeff said.
Yeah.
You're influencing the process. And I think parents have an extraordinary opportunity in the process, right? And I say that for two reasons. We get them first, and we get them most. Right? We're going to have them for the early formative years, and during those years, nobody, those first 5 years at home, nobody's going to have a better opportunity to influence them
right.
than I will. Right?
Right.
And so the Spirit wants us to seize that opportunity. I thought about Deuteronomy 6.
Yep.
Absolutely. Since we're talking about kids, I can't talk about kids without talking about this text. Will you go back there to Deuteronomy 6? Are mom and dad very familiar with this text? This is kind of Moses' farewell address.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is as he's heading off from, ironically, generational transition.
It is.
End of the Exodus generation, Moses heading off to Joshua and the conquest generation. So literally we have a from fathers to sons, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the first three verses, Moses is concerned about the very thing that we're talking about tonight, generational faith. If you look at verse 1, now this is the commandment, the statutes, the judgments, which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might possess them in the land where you are going over to possess it. Look at verse 2. So that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all of his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, and a land flowing with milk and honey. Do you see how Moses' concern is that future generations, after he's gone, after the generation of conquest dies, that future generations will continue to serve the Lord? He's concerned about that. That's his thought here.
Right. Absolutely right.
And so what does he say to them? Look at verse 3. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God. the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Let's just pause there.
Yep.
Being able to instill faith, encourage faith in your children, begins with our faith. Someone said, I don't have any of your names attached. I just have the phone numbers when I get these comments. Someone says, I think we ought to be way more concerned about nominal Christians than atheists.
Well, that's exactly right, because the people who make the world look acceptable as a Christian are, it's kind of like, the whole thing, what makes error the most dangerous is not the stuff that's 100% flamboyantly wrong. It's the stuff that's got a kernel of truth in it. And the same thing with Christian living. It's the worldly Christian. Because that's the thing. Just say this, and I really will stop, because I'll watch the clock for you.
Do you know how?
No. I took my glasses off. We don't live life in neutral. We live life with a trajectory. We're either growing closer to God or closer to the world. We're either becoming more holy or more worldly. Right? And there's all sorts of checks on that. When somebody challenges you about what you believe or what you're doing, if you get angry, guess what? That's actually a red flag that you're growing more worldly, because your love is for the world more than the truth or the correction or whatever, right? There's all sorts of, but we're not in neutral. So the worldly Christian is somebody who's already sliding back into the world. They love the world enough to mix the worldliness with the Christian. And that's far more dangerous than the person who's living the openly gay or openly sexually immoral or openly drunk or whatever it is lifestyle, a full-blown works of the flesh lifestyle. The person who makes it look, and moms and dads, that means our nominal or mediocre or worldly Christianity. Teach your kids all you want, to David's point in Deuteronomy 6, but your life will teach as much as your words will.
What is caught is more important than what is
correct.
Taught.
David could write Psalms, but at the end of the day, his kids lived like he did with Bathsheba.
Yeah.
And that's a terrifying thing to think about for those of us who are parents.
So here's the thing. Whatever our kids observe about us, they will assume that that's normative for disciple. That's what a disciple is. And I would add what they observe in our church family. They will assume that this is what disciples are. And I would add, you never know who the kids are watching. I am astonished sometimes about people that kids mention to me that caught their attention. Not necessarily not someone who's up front in front of the audience doing something all the time, just people in the crowd that they notice. And so it isn't just about mom and dad, as important as that is. Even as a church family, what they see in us, that is what it is to be a disciple. It is Christianity. And I really, really think we ought to ponder that. I got 7 minutes to read the rest of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, verse 6, these words I'm commanding you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. So, I don't know. I see two tiers of teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
There are these formal opportunities where mom and dad sit down with the book open. I think about doing Bible class lessons at the breakfast table on Saturday morning.
Sure.
And then there's just the life opportunities, the teaching moments that pop up along the way where we get an opportunity to talk to them about God.
Including when our kids ask questions. Because Deuteronomy has several places where when your son asks you, why do we do this? That's when mom and dad step in and give them the word of God.
But if I can just take one step back before that, you see, the only reason a kid would be moved to do that is because that's what fills the atmosphere of our home, right? Can I challenge y'all to think about that? Because it's important whether you got kids at home or not. But what is the atmosphere that fills your home? In fact, sometimes you can just measure this by quietly listening to what the family's talking about. What's the conversation at the house? And I think what Moses is arguing for is we need to make God's word the atmosphere that fills our home all the time. That doesn't mean you don't talk about homework or what the Astros did. It's better, Matthew, okay? Doing better. But if that's the atmosphere at house, guys, we're breathing the wrong air. And so I'd really challenge you to think about that.
Well, and let's make this concrete. What we want is a home where the kids know that mom or dad know as much about the Bible as they do about sports, number one.
And number two,
I was going to go next. Number two.
Oh, I'm sorry, I ripped you off.
No, I do it to you all the time, so feel free. Number two, though, you do. Yeah, and then the next crucial part is, because this is where the heart, you mentioned the heart earlier, in Deuteronomy 6 is about the heart, love the Lord your God. Not only do I know as much about the Bible as I do about the Astros or whatever it is, Aggie football, we'll get real personal, but I care as much about God. I'm as passionate about God. I'm as much at war against sin as I am concerned about these lesser things. And by the way, you may do number one well, and number two is where we get caught. Our kids will catch our passion as much as they will our knowledge. Your kids know what's really important to you. They really do. They figure it out. If there's an idol in your life, your kids know, because you can't help but make it the priority, make it what you talk about when you rise up, when you lie down, when you sleep. You talk about what's important to you. And so if your kids know, you know, your passion is in sports, your passion is in business, your passion is in whatever, your kids are going to know that there is something higher in your life than God.
So you're talking about something that Randy talks about all the time, mm-hmm. and that is the lived relationship.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you're living your relationship with God before them, and they see the things that matter to you.
Right.
Another thing I want to tag on to that is I think there's a big difference between knowing Bible facts and being convinced that the Bible is true. Does that make sense? Are y'all with me on that? So take the story of Jonah, for example. It's one thing to teach your kids about Jonah, that Jonah was swallowed by the great fish, and then the fish spit him out, and he went and he prophesied to Nineveh. You get all those facts lined up. I mean, let me say this, though. It's a very different thing to ask your kids, do you believe that that really happened? Because there's a world of people out there that thinks it's pretty dumb to believe that story. And so we got to push that next level and ask them, do you really believe that's true? You could teach the kids the facts about the resurrection. Jesus died on the cross and rose on the third day. We rehearse that regularly. We make remarks before the Lord's Supper. But have you ever talked to your kids, do you believe that someone could die and literally be dead in the tomb and come back to life? Are you convinced that's true? Because most of the world doesn't believe that.
Right, and they think it's foolishness.
They think it's foolishness. That's exactly right.
And to even go one step with that, David, the other thing is, and think about this, you know, we want them to actually know, you know, work the belief in the facts we teach them. We want them to learn to think in terms of the facts we teach them. That's part of what I was actually getting at in the reflection this morning from Corinthians. The Corinthians knew about the cross. They did not think in terms of the cross. And Paul's whole point is it shows throughout your entire congregation and your life. Here's a bunch of examples of in your congregation where you do not understand how to think in terms of the cross. Yep. And so that's the thing that we want for our kids. It's not just a letter of the law. We want them to absorb the spirit of the law so they don't just, you know, basically stay this side of the speed limit. They can think wisely and godly as Christians can think. And that's basically what Paul's blasting the Corinthians for in that letter is you guys know some of the facts. You have no idea how to think in terms of the facts.
Let me ask y'all to think about one more thing because we're getting ready to get hit with the bell. I would invite you to read through the Gospels and watch Jesus interact with his disciples and use that as a model for parenting. One of the things I love about Jesus' interaction with his disciples is kind of this ongoing conversation. You know, he asks them questions all the time.
What do you think?
Who do men say that I am? Yeah. Who do you think I am? Yeah. Read the stories of him interacting with his disciples, and think about the opportunity to interact that way with your kids. Wow, we did not manage time well tonight. Let's pray before the kids come in. Father, we're so grateful to have this chance to think about our young people. Thank you for blessing us with so many. And we ask you to give us wisdom to make our work determined, to make our efforts great as we try to care for them well. Bless our efforts. In Jesus' name, amen.